This is 209 Radio. Welcome to So Far and Yet So Near. Hi there, I am Derek Thorne.
And I am Hannah Higginson, and this is the show that covers a diverse range of global issues for Cambridge's community radio station.
And this show comes to you at the end of Fair Trade Fortnight 2006, so we'll be hearing about some opposing views on fair trade and free trade, and what roles should they play in the future.
Also coming up, a Muslim poet tells us about his life, work and inspirations.
And we speak to an expert on famine and learn how famine and obesity might be linked. This is So Far and Yet So Near on 209 Radio.
As part of Fair Trade Fortnight, a debate took place on Monday the 13th at King's College. The motion was that this House believes that free trade is better than fair trade. Rupert Myers, a student at the university, was first to speak, highlighting to the audience that protectionism and subsidies, when governments tax goods coming into the country and subsidise goods being exported from the country, are causing poverty in the developing world. Rupert started off by telling us the key differences between fair trade and free trade.
Fair trade tries to increase the cost of an item to give more to the people at the developing country end to produce the raw materials that go into the item. Free trade is a model that works on the premise that we basically pay for things whatever they cost. It's a demand-supply model without this kind of interference through conscience-based investment. Free trade basically means that the cost is decided by the demand and by the supply, and we pay for things what they actually cost to produce, not what we think they should cost to produce if we take into account ethical considerations. But that isn't what we have at the moment. We have a very mixed model because of protectionism and trade barriers. We don't have essentially fair trade or free trade because at the moment we have barriers to import. We like to keep our own produce and our own products, and we charge tariffs and taxes on things that are imported. So we don't have a free trade model at the moment. A pure free trade model would mean that something would basically cost however much it costs to produce.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you, in the free trade model, would encourage development within developing countries?
Well, the difference is that the fair trade model encourages development by paying the farmers and hoping that somehow that money then gets spent on the local communities. We think that basically investment has to come from the root of the problem, and the root of the problem is that these people don't have the infrastructure, the schools, the hospitals, the irrigation, the education that would enable them to live more fruitful and enjoyable lives. And so instead of just giving more money to farmers, we should be spending money on their behalf on the things that they would really benefit them. And so our model is predicated upon spending money on hospitals and schools rather than giving it to individuals who unfortunately then don't have the resources to spend it on anyway.
Don't you think, though, within sort of your mindset, you see economic development in a very linear fashion, that developing countries want to get to exactly where we are? Maybe that isn't where they want to be.
Yes, I think there is an argument for saying that not all countries want to have the sort of, the anglicised liberal democracy that we have. But that doesn't mean to say that they don't want to be able to compete with us on for the quality of our products. I mean, if they want to produce, look, they're the ones producing chocolate. We're not telling them to. They want to produce these things. They're their natural resources, and they know what they can produce well. What we're saying is they should be able to produce those on a level playing field. We're not saying what they should spend their money on. We're not saying, how they should lead their lives. We're just saying that there are ways in which we can help them to be given the freedom to compete with us in a fair way and to choose their own moral goals and cultural goals.
How would industries in developing countries get beyond the primary stage? How would they industrialize without some form of protectionism? How would that happen in the free trade model?
Well, the reason that we've seen the boom in the East at the moment is because we're moving sources of production of high-tech goods there. We're moving, some of the skills or staff we need. We're moving the employment over there. And the reason for that is that they've been given a great education. The technology colleges and the school system is what has led to the boom in some of these Eastern countries. And what we want to do is recognize that fact and to invest in the education in the futures. Invest in the futures of people in the developing world, not just in the present. We need to be looking at the infrastructure. And that isn't isn't covered by fair trade. What it's covered by is better investment. And one of the ways in which we suggest that investment is, as I've said before, by reducing the barriers to trade and spending the money that we spend on protectionism on the education that will enable people to leave school or even maybe university and say, hey, you know, I don't want to work on a farm. I want to do something in technology industry, you know, and that can't happen at the moment because, unfortunately, people in these developed countries aren't getting the educations that...
But don't you think one of the reasons they can't work in the technology industry is because that industry doesn't exist within that country because it hasn't been protected in order to be able to develop?
I disagree with that. I think that if we were to educate people to the same extent that they're educated in this country, if we were to educate them in developing countries, then large companies, multinational countries, would immediately invest in those countries because...
Multinational companies don't invest in education, though, so that would be through aid.
No. The aid would be invested in education, and the multinational companies would invest in... Sorry, excuse me. the companies would invest in setting up production facilities, in setting up the industry, because if you want to build a computer and you need, you know, technically minded staff for that, you have to look for the technically minded staff. And what happens is if we start educating these people to the extent that they can have those technical skills, then companies will come in and they will set up computer manufacturing industries in these countries, because it will be profitable for them to do so. And
so more aid, not fair trade.
In the short term, yes. I think the answer is that we should be... I mean, fair trade is a great thing. Fair trade has done a lot of good. But what we think is that fair trade has perhaps a stopgap to a better solution, and that better solution is free trade. And people should be using their very influential voice. Instead of focusing on fair trade, they should now be talking about free trade. And yes, more investment in the infrastructure and the development of these countries.
Thanks ever so much. So, are you convinced? Well, next up is Barbara Crowther from the Fair Trade Foundation. The Fair Trade Foundation is a consumer label that licenses products which meet internationally recognised standards with the Fair Trade mark. You will probably have seen the blue and green symbol on lots of primary products, raw materials that come from the earth like coffee, bananas and cocoa. Barbara started off by giving me a crash course in what fair trade is.
Fair trade is a way that we as ordinary shoppers, when we go out buying products like coffee, tea, bananas, cotton, sugar, things that come from developing countries, it's a way that we can ensure that the producers of those products have received a fair price, enough to keep their families alive and enough to invest in their communities and their future. And we believe that trade can be used to tackle poverty, and fair trade is one way that we as shoppers can support that idea.
What is the Fair Trade Foundation doing to try and move some of those your dependence away from primary products to maybe a finished product that could be produced in those countries?
First of all, we can move those farmers from producing just basic commodities into making sure they're producing the very best quality. So with fair trade premiums, they can invest in making sure that their beans are the best quality. They can go for organic certification, so they can look at moving up the value chain in that way without necessarily going into manufacturing. Now, in the case of Brazil nut oil, there are fair trade products out there that are, you know, where the Brazil nuts are gathered, the oil is pressed, it's bottled, it's even labelled in the country of origin. In the case of Quapa Cocoa, a cocoa cooperative in Ghana, those farmers are now one-third owners of the Day Chocolate Company based in London. They're on the board of the company. The better, the more that company is successful in selling chocolate to people here, the more those farmers will also benefit.
Now, one of the common themes, interestingly, between the two sides that you were both very anti EU and US and I guess Japan's subsidies of their products. That is basically arguing for free trade because you want them to drop their subsidies. How do you deal with that? How does that fit in with the fair trade model?
I said right at the start that it's not that all free trade is bad. The problem that we have at the moment is that the Western governments are preaching free trade at poor countries and, you know, right across the board and saying they have to open up their markets right across the board, whether it's services, manufacturing industries, agriculture. And they're preaching that, but we're not doing it ourselves. So we're saying, you know, if we really do believe that, we would practice it, not just preach it. So I think there are examples, you know, for our, you know, do we really depend on our domestic sugar beet industry for the future? Should we not not be phasing out that the subsidies on those types of industry. Now there may be other elements. We may choose that, you know, some form of support to our dairy industry, given that dairy farmers are constantly crying out about low prices. Some form of support to our dairy industry might still be in order. The question is the UK free to decide what it does and doesn't do, or is it being forced down a route of free trade at all costs right across the board?
But do you think it's also fair trade at all costs, like with you agreeing to support companies like Nescafe and Starbucks? Where do you draw the line?
Well, I mean, when we're talking about fair trade, we're simply saying, you know, we think that trade should not be seen as an end in itself, that trade should have the purpose of boosting sustainable development in an ecologically sensitive way, in a way that empowers poor people and poor communities. So, you know, we've been working on coffee for a very long time. We know that five companies buy 50% of the world coffee supplies. We know that 50% of all instant coffee drinkers in the UK drink Nescafe. Now the question is, are we going to convert those Nescafe drinkers to fair trade? Now maybe if we bring the strength of the Nescafe brand to play in the fair trade market, maybe we will convince some of those Nescafe drinkers who, quite frankly, you know, they've not yet been lured by the existing offer.
So it seems like fair trade has sort of moved away from idealism to pragmatism. Is that something you'd agree with?
I think we are idealists, but in living in a pragmatic world. So, you know, I don't think we've changed the original vision of fair trade. Fair trade was set up to give a better deal to farmers and workers in Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean. Now, we always said that the setting up of the fair trade mark and independent consumer label was there so that we could take fair trade out of the ghetto, if you like, and into the mainstream. We always said that right from the start. I think we didn't necessarily expect that such big companies would show interest quite so early in the, you know, in the process of developing fair trade. So yes, maybe it's moved quite quickly, but we always said that we wanted to mainstream the idea of fair trade. We're still wanting to do that. You know, we've still only got 5% of the instant coffee market. You know, that's 95% we've still got to go out there and get. So, you know, we shouldn't necessarily be turning people away when we've still got such a long way to go.
That was Barbara Crowther from the Fair Trade Foundation in London. Now to someone a bit closer to home. Joe Ash from Arjuna on Mill Road told us about what the cooperative had been doing to celebrate Fair Trade Fortnight.
We've just been making the public community aware of fair trade as much as we can. We've had different people come to talk to us. We've had the Harambee Centre. They're going to come and talk to us on Saturday. We've kind of tried to make it, you know, accessible to families as well, and done some children's activities with children.
Fantastic. And we're here today at Anglia Ruskin University. Can you tell us what we're doing here?
Yeah, we're just giving out free fair trade samples, sort of dried fruit and chocolate, and free fair trade coffee and cocoa, asking people if they want to sign a petition to get involved with fair trade. Giving fair trade information out and just generally talking to the students and lecturers.
And are people receptive? Do most people know about fair trade? Are they interested? What's the response like?
The response has been really positive. Yeah, some people already have quite a good knowledge of fair trade. Some are very interested in it and eager to learn more. Some, yeah, it's generally really good.
And why does an organisation like Arjuna, that's an independent cooperative, why does it support things like fair trade, and why should people buy it from you?
Because basically we are essentially into promoting ethical consumerism as much as we can and as much as is realistic, really. And also we're supportive of independent business, and you know, it's better really if people support Arjuna rather than the jolly supermarkets.
Fantastic. And what's your favourite fair trade product?
My favourite fair trade product, possibly the cocoa, and Mayer Gold Green and Black. So I'm a bit of a soft one for that.
That's Joe Ash from Arjuna speaking there. Now, if you've been following the world news recently, you might have been aware that East Africa has been hit by some serious water and food shortages. Now, although famines like this form a strong part of our image of Africa in modern times, it turns out that famine has taken place throughout human history in various parts of the world. And what's more, this history of famine could well be related to the levels of obesity that we now see in more developed nations. Explaining all this to an audience here in Cambridge was one of the lecturers in the recent Darwin series, Andrew Prentice, who is from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. According to him, humans have developed thrifty genes, which help us store fat when food is plentiful. But these genes have now backfired on people in richer nations where food is usually plentiful, and obesity is the result. He began by giving me some background on some different kinds of famine.
I guess we would think of two kinds. One is caused by what's often been called unkind nature, so droughts, massive hailstorms, unseasonal frosts, that kind of thing. And the second kind would be man's inhumanity to man, warfare, sieges of cities, and so forth.
And what about famines that kind of come around every year, then?
Yes, there are seasonal famines, which used to affect us in northern latitudes, such as England, very, very regularly, and still affect many people around the world. And these are when you have a hungry period, when people have run out of their food crops from the previous year, and before the next harvest is ready.
So then, looking back in history, I mean, is famine a recent phenomenon, or have these famines happened over, you know, mankind's history?
I wasn't aware the extent to which famine has been an ever-present threat to our survival until I did a lot of reading on it. And when you do that, you find just an incredible historical record of famines occurring at least once a generation in most histories that one can read.
And how well have we managed to adapt to them and get around them?
Well, we've survived, clearly. We've survived and indeed prospered. And there are many different strategies that we use to do that. One could think of them as metabolic, how the body responds to famine and protects itself. You can think of behavioral strategies, of which there are many. And then whole population strategies, governments putting food aside to store for when times are bad, for instance.
Now, looking at the news at the moment, for example, it seems that a famine is happening in East Africa, for example. Is famine something that has happened more, would you say, of late than it has over mankind's history? Or indeed, have we become less good at dealing with it of late?
I very much hope we're getting an awful lot better at dealing with it. And again, the historical record would show that in, for instance, the late Victorian era, there were massive famines with between 30 and 60 million people dying in India and China. So we're getting very much better. And most of the things that blocks progress now are indeed governments that are uncooperative with aid efforts and warfare.
Now, you've been looking at the way in which the body can actually kind of get round famine, can survive from it. So tell me more about that.
There are absolutely fascinating mechanisms. The first thing the body needs to do is to detect how thin or fat it is, how much energy, how many reserves it's got on board. And we've only just discovered the hormone that does this. It's called leptin, and that sends a signal to the brain. It's essentially the body's fuel gauge. And that allows the brain to orchestrate a whole lot of changes which use up body fat predominantly and protect the vital organs and make the body last as long as possible.
What kind of permanent changes, as it were, is this having on the human?
We have inherited a really ancient metabolism that's been trained to survive famine. And we see the consequences of this now because we never have famines in the Western world. We're constantly feasting. And of course, obesity is the greatest example of our inheritance of these so-called thrifty genes. But I think also there's evidence to suggest that a lot of the disordered eating that's going on is a confusion that's caused by our having evolved to survive famine.
Can you tell me about that in a bit more detail? I mean, how is it that they're all connected? How is it that those genes are connected to famine and also to obesity?
Well, we're not quite sure yet. There's this wonderful phrase, thrifty genes, which people use a lot. But actually, it's a very nebulous phrase, which we don't fully understand yet. But I would argue that obesity is not a pathological response now. It's the absolutely natural response to the change in our environment against the background of having survived famine in the past.
Okay, now when we look at the bigger picture around the world, I mean, obviously the population of the Earth is increasing, and to look at it logically, one might think, well, the food is eventually going to run out. I mean, is that right?
Malthus, of course, 200 years ago or so, was the first to bring up these arguments and suggested that massive famine was a necessary way of keeping human population in check with and in line with food supplies. Now, actually, population growth is slowing quite rapidly now. And food supply, although some people have argued that we had big increases and then it's been static, in fact what they haven't taken into account is that we're spending millions of pounds and euros and dollars on set-aside, so there's still a lot of capacity to produce extra food. So I don't think there's likely to be a massive famine unless, And of course, this is the big, big question. Climate change causes a catastrophic change.
And exactly how could climate change do that?
Well, by changing the temperature, and of course all the crops that we have been trained and grown and bred to survive under various conditions, but also by swamping vast areas of arable land around the world if sea levels rise.
That's Andrew Prentice from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. Now, don't forget you can get in touch with us on sofar@209radio.co.uk. And if you want to have this show delivered to your computer every time it comes out, then why not podcast it?
All you have to do is download some podcasting software, such as iTunes, and then click on the podcast link for our show's page and copy the addresses into your programme. If you're still puzzled, check out the frequently asked questions on the 209 website.
And also, a quick shout-out for an event. If you want to come and meet some of the people behind 209 Radio and also some other organisations in Cambridge, do come along to the Creative Careers Fair at the Junction on March the 25th. Now, in our last episode, we had a little bit of coverage in the Cambridge University's Experience Islam Week, which was in February. Well, an event that took place at the very end of that week was a Day of Islamic Culture, and one of the presenters there was a Muslim poet called Brother Dash. I spoke to him after he'd read out a few of his poems, and he firstly told me what subjects he liked to focus on.
Most of my poetry can be described as spiritual poetry, pertaining specifically to Islam. And also I do some socio-political poetry as well, commenting on history, race, gender issues, that sort of thing. So it's sort of probably an 80-20 mix, with the 80 being the spiritual poetry that I do, because I feel it's important now, for especially in light of today's current events with the political antagonistic kind of approach that is being taken, unfortunately, on both sides. I'm not going to totally blame the media for that. I mean, Muslims have brought their own to the table as well, but because you have so much of that, it's important to bring out the artistic side of Islam, which is what appealed, you know, one of the things that appealed to me. Political Islam never appealed to me. Actually, if anything, it was a repelling force. But the peaceful nature of the faith, that is what appealed to me, and that is what I like to focus on in my poetry.
And you've also been talking about how the very strong culture of art has been rather overlooked recently in Islam. Tell me more about that.
Sure. Well, if you look historically, and we need only go to Andalusia, basically the Muslim Spain, as it was called when it was under the rule of the Muslims for over 700 years. During that time, wonderful time, where you basically had Christians, Jews, and Muslims, for the most part, who got along very well as a plural society. And the Muslims were the government that was in charge, but they were not a repressive government. And they promoted, in fact, the artistic side of Islam, where you had burgeoning Islamic music, art, not only that, but you also had poetry. And unfortunately, we had gone through several centuries where that was pushed to the side and a more political type of Islam was brought to the forefront. Now we're starting to see a return where you have now Muslim hip-hop groups, you have Muslim singers, and they're not only doing sort of the Arabic-influenced kind of Islamic music, but they're doing music that a non-Muslim Westerner would listen to. It has the kind of beats and cadence, and that's so, like, my poetry, for example, has elements of hip-hop, it has elements of jazz, that sort of thing, all fused together to form this spoken word poetry that is totally Islamic, but it's Islamic in a way that comes from my experience as a convert to Islam. I did not grow up as a Muslim. As a convert, so I'm bringing my style, my art to this, and Islam totally promotes that. It's not about one particular culture dictating how the rest of the world is supposed to view the faith, but it's about taking the good of your culture, the good of my culture, putting it together and forming something beautiful.
And tell me about some of the different places you perform at as well. I mean, whereabouts in the world, for example?
Well, I've performed mainly in the United States and here in the UK now. In terms of the States, all over. NYU, Columbia, so all of your major universities, and then also your major Islamic conferences in the States. I've also been interviewed on several radio stations in the States, television I've done in the United States as well. So I've done a lot of media, I've done a lot of live events. So mainly these two countries.
That's Brother Dash there, and apologies for the screaming baby in the background. That's not a reaction to his poetry. And if you'd like to hear some of it, of course, you can go to muslimpoet.com. And one final word, Brother Dash is from New Jersey, something I forgot to mention in the queue, but he'd actually been flown over especially for the event. So Cambridge University Islamic Society were very happy to have him there.
So now to our next feature. The Andreasen Centre is open every Thursday at the Friends Meeting House on Hartington Grove. The work of Professor Andreasen is the inspiration for the centre, as the name suggests. Andreasen was a doctor who became interested in a more holistic approach to medicine and prescribed homeopathy, kinesiology and acupuncture in his practice. The centre gives people the opportunity to receive healing at what they describe as a no-appointment barbershop every Thursday. Michelle Bernard, both a healer and client at the centre, told me about the benefits of healing.
I think people always feel better after coming here. Healing's a very relaxing, gentle therapy, and I think most people feel more relaxed and calm, if not better, more energised.
And where does this practice of healing come from? Is it based on Eastern philosophy, like a lot of the alternative therapies, or where does it come from?
I think healing has been here since that time began. A lot of people, you know, of course, say Jesus was a healer. Healing ability has been documented for, you know, thousands of years. And I think it's existed in different forms and in different traditions, in slightly different ways. And I think people are more interested in it now because complementary therapies are becoming more well-known, more recognised, and people are experiencing the benefits of them. That's why.
And is the healing that takes place here, would you consider it a complementary therapy, or is it a little bit different from that? How does it fit in?
Well, it's a complementary therapy in that it can go along with any other kind of treatment you're having. It doesn't contradict any other kind of medical treatment that you might be having. Healers don't diagnose, they don't advise on treatment, they don't ever countermand anything doctors or medical staff do. It's very much a complementary therapy, it's not an alternative therapy, because it works with other therapies and it will create a sense of well-being, peace, balance. It aims to balance the person's mind, body and spirit and promote a self-healing response in the person.
So how often do you come to be healed, and would you mind telling us a little bit about your experience of healing?
Well, as I come here every week to give healing, and I work with sometimes one other probationer, and we sort of swap. So I have a lot of experience of receiving healing as well. And in my own experience, I always feel better. I always feel calmer, more energized. If I have got a particular problem, like today, like a cold, I've always felt I've had more energy and more grounded as well after receiving the healing. There are lots of things you can experience during healing. Some people don't feel anything and some people feel a lot of things, and it doesn't matter because they will still receive the healing. As a healer, I may be slightly more sensitive to these energies, and I feel a lot in my case. You know, I feel tingling, heat, energy moving around my body, going to different places, pain coming to the surface and dissolving. I do experience quite a lot of phenomena, but some people don't, and it doesn't matter.
If you want to drop in on the centre, then you can go along between 2:30 and 4:30 every Thursday to the Friends Meeting House on Hartington Grove off Hills Road, and look out for the centre's 20th birthday celebrations in June.
And so that's all for another edition of So Far and Yet So Near, so thanks very much for joining us. I will unfortunately be away for the next month or so. I'm actually off to Tanzania to work on what else? Community radio. But Hannah is going to be handling everything. And next week, Hannah, do tell us, what is it? Sorry, next show, indeed. What's going to be happening?
Well, we've got a special so far and yet so near, actually, because we will be covering the U8, a student conference that took place in Cambridge a couple of weeks ago, with people attending from all over the globe, tackling and looking at the issue of international development.
And also, for the show after that, if we can actually get it working, then we're going to have a crack at getting an interview with me over the internet while I'm in Tanzania. So who knows, you might even hear from me.
Fingers crossed.
So there you go. So until then, thanks for listening and goodbye.
And goodbye from me too.